we'll commence with session B of this particular session called War and Views of War in England. I have assumed the responsibility of chairmanship, and therefore we have decided among us to reverse the order of the papers as listed on your sheet. And first we will have Michael R. Sponberg from West Virginia University, who is currently working under Professor Levine and doing work on Henry VIII's Navy. He is presently on a research grant at Folger Library. So Mr. Sponberg will begin, and then we will follow that by Mr. McGinney's topic on English views of the French Wars of Religion. Mr. Sponberg.
My paper, the research for which utilized standard monographs dealing with the Tudor Navy, besides the letters and papers, foreign and domestic, of the reign of King Henry VIII, is a study of that monarch's hand in ship design, the appointment of naval officers, and tactical decisions. Considerable emphasis was also devoted to the recruitment of enlisted personnel and the problem of privateering and piracy. After defeating Richard III at Bosworth Field, Henry Tudor spent the years 1485 to 1509 consolidating the realm and securing the Tudor crown. Henry VII never seriously contemplating retaking the territory lost to France at the conclusion of the Hundred Years' War. Not so his son. One of Henry VIII's chief ambitions, and it prompted him to take up arms three times, was to regain the territory lost in 1455 and to win the French crown, which he fancied was rightly his. The English navy saw only limited action in the first two wars, 1512 to 1514 and 1523 to 1525. During the Third War, however, the navy assumed an important role. It is during these years, 1544 to 1546, that the monarch's hand in English naval matters is most clearly seen. Henry was taught to adore ships by his father. On several occasions, he fancied himself a mariner, dressing up in a boatswain's uniform made of cloth of gold and velvet, and blowing on a boatswain's whistle as if he were an expert. Of all the king's maritime amusements, nothing pleased him more than to watch gunnery practice. The hammer of the monks loved to have enormous targets established in the region of Houndsditch and crow with delight when he saw them demolished by the discharge of his monstrous weapons. These new monstrous weapons, called kirtles, were brass muzzle loaders, weighed 3,000 pounds, and could easily sink an enemy vessel. The Mary Rose, Peter Pomegranate, and Sovereign were fitted with four or five kirtles each, in 1509. Henry VIII's warships may be divided into two classifications. The first type, consisting of the largest ships in his navy, ranged from 600 to 1,000 tons or more, built carvel or high-charged style. These ships were of increased beam and depth, with towering poops and forecastles designed essentially for boarding and hand-to-hand combat. This ship was a carryover from Henry VII's administration, and it was armed with a 300-pound serpentine, culverin, and demi-culverin. None of these weapons were meant to sink vessels. Their primary purpose was to kill enemy personnel and to destroy masts and rigging. The second type was variously referred to by contemporaries of the king as a galley, galleon, or galleus. The latter is the most accurate term, since the new ship, an invention of the king himself, combined the rowing galley with the four-masted galleon, or traditional warship. These were built throughout the reign, beginning with the Mary Rose in 1509, and included the Antelope, Tiger, Bull, and Hart, all of which were built in 1546. Propelled both by oars and sails, these were fitted with a beakhead like a galley, and they had low poops and forecastles. And the last four galleys built were almost flush-decked. For armament, these carried, besides serpentines and culverins and demi-culverins, they carried also the 3,000-pound kirtle, which eventually revolutionized marine warfare. Naval historian Jeffrey Callender discusses in detail the method of mounting the heavier cannons, which allowed Henry VIII to send to sea what Callender called the new broadside ship. James Baker, master shipwright to the king, is credited with adapting the French port or cargo door to English ships. By modifying the port to the extent that the door could be opened and closed many times while the ship was at sea, Henry's new muzzle-loading kirtles could be mounted near the waterline, rolled forward for firing, retracted for reloading, and wheeled forward to fire again. Baker further modified the concept of the port by cutting as many doors as he dared in the hull of the ship. Callender considers the development of the Henrician broadside ship a landmark in the science of naval warfare. In Callender's words, "With the evolution of the broadside ship, that is, of a vessel mounting inside her hull as many guns as she could conveniently carry, Henry VIII revolutionized the science of shipbuilding and endowed his realm with a weapon of war, compared with which the Zeppelin is but as dust and the balance and the tank a very little thing." The letters and papers show Henry VIII's hand in day-to-day naval matters during the Third War. In the 1545 campaign, the monarch insisted on naming ship captains. Viscount Lisle, Great Admiral, wrote to Crown Advisor Sir William Paget on August 2nd, stating that, "By his letter delivered today, perceives that because of the disease of Sir William Woodhouse, Inglos, and other captains who have lately fallen sick, the king will have other gentlemen named as meet for the vacant places." 5 days later, another of Lisle's letters to Paget indicates the king's interest in naming captains. More than a year later, on September 20th, 1546, the council in London wrote to the council with the king, stating, "We delivered money for the pressing of men, and the Lord Great Master provided for their victualling. It remains for the king to appoint and instruct their admiral." Henry also issued tactical orders. In a letter to Paget on August 2nd, 1545, Lisle indicates Henry's interest in naval strategy. "In a letter, the king," quoting Lisle, "found fault with the lying of the ships and wished that they should repair to the strait on this side St. Ellen's Point." The message stated that Henry's orders were carried out. An entry entitled The Narrow Seas of August 36 began with this introduction: "Instructions given by the King's Majesty to Sir Thomas Clare, Knight, Vice Admiral of England, for his proceedings in the Narrow Seas." The instructions following meticulously explained Henry's wishes. The final message in the year 1546 telling Henry's wishes concerning the Navy was sent from the Privy Council to Lisle on May 19th. The Privy Councillor stated, "The King is this day advertised that notwithstanding the French Admiral's promise, their galleys remain at Nace Point between Rye and Hastings, watching to intercept English victuallers appointed to come shortly to Dover. Thinking it both dangerous and dishonorable to permit this, His Majesty would have you order some of the galleasses, row barges, and greater vessels with the next tide to meet the said galleys and to give them the setting on in the name of God." Evidence in the letters and papers indicates confusion among the correspondents concerning ships variously labeled galleon, galley, or galleas. On December 31st, 1540, the French ambassador in England, Charles de Marillac, wrote to Francis I concerning developments at the English court. He closed his dispatch by noting that there was no other news these holidays but of mummeries and rejoicing, except that 6 galleys to be constructed are not yet commenced, and this king instead is making a fine galleon. The imperial ambassador in England, Eustace Chapuys, wrote to Charles V on July 16, 1541, discussing a variety of subjects, and closed his message saying, "The king has also sent to Italy for 3 shipwrights expert in making galleys. But he will not set them to work, as he has begun to make ships with oars of which he himself is the architect. Lyell wrote to Paget on August 7, 1545, listing his proposed alterations in naval command assignments. Among the other proposed changes, Lyell stated, "The gentleman that was one of the rudes and made means to serve the king shall be in the small galley. If the king will have one man in charge of all the rowing pieces, William Tyrrell is the fittest gentleman in the army, for he is a man that hath seen the feet of the galleys, and is a sure man and a diligent in anything that he is committed unto." February 25, 1846, Paget wrote to the English diplomat in Germany, Christopher Mont, and described the new vessels. "Our admiral, God's own knight," Paget notes, "commands a fleet with 16,000 mariners and men of war, for the which company there is no more prepared but four ships, the least of 800 tons, and 25 other vessels, like galleys to row, saving that where the galley shooteth but from the proar, these shoot from all sides, like another ship, and from the proar also." Finally, on March 23, 1546, a correspondent, identified only as Sepphoris, wrote to naval officer Sir Richard Granville describing the English fleet. "This king has 50 great ships of his own, in addition to those taken for his service from the emperor's subjects and other foreigners, so that he will have a stronger navy than last year. Four galleasses will be ready by Lent, and six galleons of a new type." So all five different passages I have cited refer to different ships, different names, but possibly they are not clear in their mind just exactly the correct name for which for each ship they're talking about. Now the Oxford English Dictionary clarifies these terms. A galley, according to the OED, is defined as a low, flat-built, sea-going vessel with one deck, propelled by sails and oars, formerly in common use in the Mediterranean. A galleon is defined as being shorter but higher than a galley, a ship of war, chiefly Spanish, and also a trading ship with the New World. A galleas, on the other hand, was a heavy, low-built vessel, larger than a galley, impelled both by oars and sail, chiefly employed in war. Now, judging from these descriptions, it may be said that the fine galleon mentioned by Marillac and the six galleons of a new type, referred to by Sepphoris, were probably the conventional great ships which I have described earlier in this paper. As for the ships with oars, of which Henry VIII himself is the architect, referred to by Chapuys, and the 25 other vessels, like galleys to row, but which shoot from all sides, like another ship, mentioned by Paget, these were no doubt the same as the four new galleasses cited by Sepphoris. All three men were without doubt referring to the galleas, the new ship which combined the large hull of a galleon, but without the galleon's castles, and which included the oars and flush deck of the galley. Now, Lyell's message also warrants clarification. The admiral mentions the small galley, the name of a ship, and refers to William Tyrrell as a man that hath seen the feet of the galleys. Judging from the accounts of naval historians, Edward R. Adair and Michael Oppenheim, Lyell was not referring to galleys in the classical sense. These historians have concluded that although galleys are occasionally mentioned in the naval lists, official naval lists in Henry's reign, and mentioned in the letters and papers, there was never more than one true galley at any time in Henry's navy. That was the galley Subtle, ship with that name, launched in 1544. Now, if Lyell had been thinking of the 1544 christened ship, he surely would have used its correct name. Quite possibly, he was referring to the Less Galley, a ship with that name, a 400-ton ship purchased in 1539, but a ship obviously much larger than a galley, although one for which the name small galley might easily have inadvertently been given. The fact that the English Navy had only one galley did not prevent various officials from thinking about their usefulness, a usefulness which, in the minds of the writers, may have offset the disadvantages of the galleys on the high seas. According to Edward Adair, the utility of galleys was discussed several times during Henry's reign. Adair notes that in 1513, Sir Edward Howard, the admiral, dispatched a pressing demand for convicts to be employed in the fleet as oarsmen. And Adair notes that in 1544, the king was prepared to buy 10 galleys from the emperor along with the slaves to work them. And on May 16, 1544, Adair tells us all non-denizen Frenchmen were threatened with imprisonment in the galleys if they didn't leave England within 20 days. And then on May 26, 1545, an entry entitled Furnishing Galley Slaves indicates the seriousness of a social evil and a possible solution. The king speaks. Notwithstanding wholesome laws to preserve the people from idleness, the mother and root of all mischiefs, there remain, especially about London, a great number of ruffians and vagabonds, able to work but living by theft and falsehood in play, whereby young men are pulled and undone. The king intends to use all such ruffians, vagabonds, masterless men, common players, and evil-disposed persons to serve him in these wars in certain galleys to be armed forth before 1 June next. Now, if you are my age and went through problem of registration at age 18 and wondering in the 20s if you would be called to the colors, you might remember some statements by Lieutenant General Lewis B. Hershey. And he said, bad boys who steal cars could serve a little time in the armed forces, and it generally straightens them out. Despite the demand that prisoners and social misfits serve in galleys, no evidence exists indicating galleys were acquired for these purposes. Galleys had several disadvantages, which made their utility marginal, and the greatest disadvantage was that although they worked well in the Mediterranean, they were powerless in the high seas because they moved primarily by oars. Study in the letters and papers indicates the serious problems the Crown had with procuring enough men to serve in the Third French War. Writing from Newcastle on January 24, 1543, Lyell told the King's Council that four ships had been fitted for service and continued, "There are more pretty ships here able to serve, but no mariners and no ordnance and very little powder." The mayor and alderman of York wrote to the Earl of Shrewsbury, Lieutenant General in the North, on November 13, 1544, discussing the shortage of ships and men for the King's service. The mayor and alderman state, "Perceived by the king's letters dated Darrington that it's his pleasure to know what ships they can set forth to take the seas, have no ships nor mariners, but only lighteners that can carry merchandise betwixt Hull and York." From Exeter on August 7, 1545, naval officer John Russell told Paget of the same problem. "I am glad that some of the western ships have reached Portsmouth. I have had great ado to set them forth, chiefly for lack of mariners, of which I have sundry times advertised the council." Several entries in the letters and papers show that nearly all able-bodied seamen between 1544 and 1546 served in the king's service. Both secondary and primary sources show that Henry VIII drafted men for naval service. F.W. Brooks, an economic historian writing in the English Historical Review, referred to what he called the blind spots in nautical history concerning the wages of some merchant seamen prior to the 18th century. But the author noted, however, that much information concerning the procurement of sailors in the 16th century is available. Brooks states in part, "Probably we should not go far wrong in assuming that the wages paid to impressed seamen from the 2 pence per day of King John's reign to the 5 shillings per month of 1512 are approximately equal to what a seaman might expect to earn in private employment." primary sources show that certain commissions were issued for taking seamen, and that pressed money was delivered to these commissioners. Item 6 in an entry of September 30, 1544, entitled Grants, indicates that John Elliott, James Corswell, and William Hawkins were issued a commission which entitled them to prepare themselves to sea to annoy the king's enemies and defend the realm. The commission also allowed them to take up in counties Cornwall, Devon, Somerset, and Dorset shipmasters, pilots, mariners, gunners, and soldiers, and also victual and artillery. On November 16th, the bailiffs of Scarborough wrote to Shrewsbury, indicating their willingness to serve the king's cause, and asked for aid. Perceived by his letters dated at Darrington, 11 November, that the king marvels that the merchants and inhabitants of this town have not all this year set forth vessels for defense of their traffic, and commands his lordship to will them to do as is done in many other parts of the realm, begged to have the king's warrant to pressed mariners and fishermen. Well, the Oxford English Dictionary defines pressed as an engagement of a person by payment of earnest money, an enlistment of soldiers and sailors. And the Oxford English Dictionary refers to the state papers of Henry VIII, Volume 9, and the letters and papers, which I was using, Volume 1, and cites, for example, the phrase, ships prested for the king in the West Country. Well, more citations I have indicate that more commissions were issued during this period, 1544 to 46, and that these commissions amounted to the issuing of pressed money, and I think it equals a draft. Primary sources indicate that bad food, inordinately hot weather, and an outbreak of the plague hindered naval efforts in the summer of 1545. But besides this matter of drafting seamen, which I see as a controversial problem that Henrician naval students have to deal with, there's the problem of piracy and privateering. This is difficult to work with because Henry did not use the word privateer. The Oxford English Dictionary claims that it wasn't used until 1654. But Henry did use the term pirate. Now, the dictionary says that a privateer is one who sails with letters of marque or letters of reprisal given to him from the government in order to, one, retaliate upon sailors from a foreign nation who have taken his cargo, or two, that a sailor may take goods from the enemy at time of war. And a pirate is defined as someone who has no commission, either during peace or during war, but goes ahead anyway and takes goods. So I'm using the term synonymously, and it's something that must be worked on in the future to clear up this terminology. On August 2nd, 1545, excuse me here, maritime historian James A. Williamson notes that piracy, the bane of European waters, began during the First French War, that joint efforts taken to curb English and French depredations following the war were unsuccessful, and that the evil increased as time went on, and during the war of 1544-46, assumed, in Williamson's words, gigantic proportions. Although evidence indicates that near the Third War's conclusion, the government sought to halt depredations by English seamen of any kind, evidence also shows that the administration may have encouraged piracy or advanced privateering. This encouragement is seen in the orders given by the Privy Council on April 10, 1543. The Privy Councilors state, recognizance of John Ball of Winchelsea and Thomas Fugler and John Reynold of Rye, who have letters of marque, and recognizance of John Goulet, vintner, and George Dodds, fishmonger, as sureties for them to take Frenchmen and Scots. A letter from Naval Officer Lord William Howard to the Council on April 23, 1546, shows that the Lord Admiral had ordered him, in his words, to watch for certain hulks that were to pass through the narrow seas and stay such of them as were laden with corn or were of 800 or 900 burthen, but let all under 400 tons not laden with corn pass. Howard reported that in compliance with the order, he had commandeered 5 Dutch ships. An entry of May 18, 1546, entitled The Privy Council, mentioned that a license to Henry Golding, captain of the bark Eger, to put to sea as a pirate with 2 pinnaces of Plymouth and 80 men had been issued. What seems to have been indecisiveness on the Crown's part is shown by the fact that some seamen were ordered to take ships, but at the same time, they were told not to spoil prizes. An undated entry of 1543, entitled The Fleet in the North Seas, began with the explanation that it contained instructions given to by the king to William Woodhouse, gentleman, appointed admiral of his navy on the high seas. After this introduction, one of the instructions was the following. They shall take all Frenchmen and Scots as good prize, taking the men into their own ships and send the prizes to the next port, advertising the Lord Admiral and charging the officers of the port to see the goods safely kept. They shall not meddle with any Fleming, Spaniard, or Portingal unless he have hurt any English subjects or is conveying men and munition or victual into Scotland, in which case he is to be apprehended and kept until further instructions. Woodhouse shall see that there is no spoil of the goods of any ship he shall take. On June 13, 1543, almost the same instructions were issued to Naval Officer Sir Rice Mounsell. Almost 3 years later, an entry entitled Privy Council of May 1, 1546 noted that the king licensed John Frenchman of Rye to pass to the North Seas on his giving surety to behave well towards the king's subjects and friends and to register all prizes at the first English port. Unfortunately, not all obeyed the instructions that Henry gave to Mounsell and Howard. A letter entitled The Queen of Hungary to Chapuys on February 23, 1543, states that the captains of ships of war here daily complain to her that English ships equipped for war, when they are the stronger, constrain hers to obey them and take their victuals and tackle. Lyle wrote to Paget on April 7, 1546, mentioning the problem and the possible repercussions. Every Spaniard, Portingal, or Fleming that comes from the south is robbed by our adventurers, some calling themselves Scots and some with visors, so that if remedy be not provided, the king will be molested with complaints from the emperor's subjects. Further proof of English privateering or piracy was found in complaints registered before the Privy Council in the summer of 1546. An entry entitled The Privy Council of May 14th states that a letter was sent to the Deputy of Calais forwarding the petition of Michael Crete for fish and other goods taken by Henry Vernon's ship of Calais. The Privy Council report of May 31st noted 6 complaints by foreigners of Englishmen having commandeered their cargoes. Several times in 1546, the Privy Council had to send letters to sheriffs and other English officials telling them to capture certain pirates named in these warrants. They were warrants for arrest. And they also, the Privy Council, also issued orders calling for the restitution of the goods stolen by the pirates and for recompense to be given to the owners of spoiled ships. Developments between 1509 and 1546, as seen in secondary works and primary sources, reaffirm the time-honored maxim that Henry VIII was indeed the founder of the English Navy. The monarch's hand, as I have shown, was everywhere seen. He increased the Navy from 12 ships he received from his father to 85 at the height of the Third French War. 46 of them were built in England under his watchful eye. The monarch himself designed ships, occasionally sailed on them and kept careful records of their performances. The most startling breakthrough of his naval program, however, as I have indicated, was his influence in the development of the galleass, a ship which, with its hull-mounted kirtles, was capable for the first time of sinking enemy vessels. I think it marked a watershed in English naval history. With a careful eye, the monarch supervised the recruitment of naval personnel, personally appointed officials, and kept his hand ever present in the day-to-day development of naval strategy. Now, much of what was found in this study concerning the Henrician Navy has been studied by other historians, although not always substantiated in nearly such detail. Recognized historians have carefully chronicled the exploits of the Navy, including some of its famous actions, such as the sinking of the Regent in 1512, and the very famous demise of the Mary Rose in July 1545, the development of the kirtle, the ports for hull-mounting the weapon, design and construction of the galleass are all described in secondary works. Some secondary works have also devoted attention to the matter of piracy and privateering during Henry's reign. What is obvious, however, is that much work may profitably be devoted towards clarifying such matters as the problem of piracy in the First, Second, and Third War, Henry's recruitment troubles during the Third War, victualling difficulties in that war, the problem of the plague in the First and Third War. All of these, I think, merit attention in greater detail. And one aspect of the war is not yet studied by naval historians, is the matter of what 16th century Englishmen thought about their monarch's French wars. John R. Hale has challenged historians to devote more attention to the study of public opinion regarding what he calls Renaissance warfare. This aspect of English history, which would combine a form of intellectual and naval history, merits attention.
Thank you. We will now change our perspective a bit and find, in essence, what the English thought of the views going on in France in the religious wars. Our next speaker, Garrett McAneish, whose specialty and interest is in Renaissance France, where he did his work under Russell Major at Emory University. Mr. McAneish now will talk to us on English views of the French wars of religion.
No aspect of continental politics so fascinated Tudor England as did the French Wars of Religion. Scores of French pamphlets describing the campaigns and battles raging in France were translated into English during the last four decades of the 16th century. These narratives were joined by a number of translated documents concerning the wars, such as peace treaties, edicts of toleration, and the declarations and apologies through which French leaders attempted to justify their actions. In addition, by the end of the century, London bookstalls could boast a number of treatments of the wars from the pens of English authors. These included plays, poems, and eyewitness accounts, as well as general histories. Nor were the English content to remain passive bystanders, placidly observing events in France from a safe distance. Elizabeth sent a sizable force to the aid of the Huguenots in 1562, and an English army returned to France in 1589 to help Henry IV in his struggle with the Spanish-backed forces of the Holy League. In the years between these two official English interventions in the French wars, hundreds of young gallants out to find adventure, or to earn their bread by risking their blood, or to defend the true faith of their choice, were also drawn into the French maelstrom. The reasons for this extraordinary English interest are not difficult to discern. As Protestants, most Englishmen had a natural sympathy for the Huguenots. Indeed, for many, the events in France were not merely a human tragedy, but part of the titanic conflict between God and Satan. Anne Dowrich, a minor Elizabethan poet, explained that she was interested in the French wars because they so clearly demonstrated, quote, the great fury and rage of Satan, likely to be displaced from his kingdom of error and blindness, and the prompt facility and readiness of Satan's ministers to put in execution any kind of wickedness, end quote. Looking at the other side of the coin, Anthony Collinet, author of A Long History of the Wars, trumpeted that events in France were a perfect example of the beneficent intervention of God in human affairs. He wrote, he said, quote, "especially to consider the presence of God in governing the one, that is the Huguenot faction, and prospering him in doing profitable things for the defense of a just cause and his country, and the judgment of God, which according to the threatenings of his law doth lead the wicked to punishment," end quote. Even for those Englishmen to whom religion was not an all-consuming passion, the fate of the Huguenots was a matter of more than passing interest. The English recognized even before the wars began that the Guise family, sworn foes and implacable persecutors of France's Huguenots, were their foes too. Thus it was seen that Guise triumphs over the Huguenots in France were also defeats for England. For any increase in that Catholic family's power and prestige increased its ability to menace the island kingdom. The Guise threat became all too apparent in the summer of 1559, when Mary Stuart, niece of the Duke of Guise and his brother, the Cardinal of Lorraine, became Queen of France. Largely through her enormous influence over her hapless young husband, Francis II, the Guises became the dominant force in French politics. In the next months, the Guises also set about trying to extend their power to their niece's kingdom of Scotland. This, of course, would have put England within the jaws of a Guise vice, a situation which no English patriot could regard with equanimity. Worse still, the Guises pushed Mary's claim that she, rather than Elizabeth, was the rightful Queen of England. Nor could such a claim be taken lightly, since Henry VIII's marriage to Elizabeth's mother had never been recognized by Rome. Mary did indeed have a valid claim in Catholic eyes. Elizabeth responded to all this by backing an anti-Guise rebellion in Scotland and by publicly denouncing the Guises in England. Mary's claim to the English throne, she told her subjects in a proclamation of March 1560, quote, "hath been bred and issued only out of the hearts of the principles of the House of Guise," end quote. If any threats to the peace of her kingdom were to arise in France, she added, her subjects could be sure that it would be, quote, "upon the further instigation of the said House of Guise," end quote. The death of Mary's husband, Francis II, a few months later, eased the situation by weakening the Guise stranglehold on France and by breaking the connection between the French and Scottish crowns. Guise influence remained strong in France, though, and when war broke out there in 1562, Elizabeth lost no time in sending an expedition to Le Havre to aid their Protestant opponents. Significantly, her government claimed to be acting in self-defense here, as well as in the interest of France's Protestants. The declaration which was issued to justify this English intervention in France's troubles took the position that unless checked in France, the Catholic tyranny of the Guises would inevitably spread to England. As the French wars dragged on for the next two decades, these English fears were kept alive by Mary Stuart's adamant refusal to drop her claim to England's throne, and by continued Guise meddling in Scotland on her behalf. English pamphleteers repeatedly sounded the alarm that France's Catholics, led by the hated Guise family, had the conquest and forcible conversion of England as one of their primary goals. Thus, the English were accustomed to regarding the Guises, leaders of the Catholic cause in France's wars, as threats to their own security, even before the formation of the Holy League in 1585. This militant arm of the Counter-Reformation, with its announced goal of eliminating Protestantism from the face of the earth, could only increase English anxiety about events in France. To make matters even worse, the League bound the Guises together with Philip II of Spain, England's most dreaded enemy. Lest the English overlook the sinister implications of this move, the Huguenot leader, Henry of Navarre, quickly sent an emissary to warn Elizabeth. If the League gained control of France, he pointed out, then that country, traditionally a counterweight to the power of the Habsburgs, would come under the domination of Spain. Once that happened, English independence would be hopelessly lost. That a league triumph over the Huguenots would leave England naked before her enemies seems to have been fully appreciated by the English. One of England's diplomats pointed out in 1587 that, quote, "The security of England depends also upon the success of the wars in France. If the King of Navarre prevail, England will be the more assured," end quote. English interest in the French wars, as measured by the number of works about them which appeared in English translation, picked up enormously after the formation of the League. Only 20 translations, of which we have any record, had appeared in the 12 years between 1573 and 1584, but 8 were published in 1585 and 8 more in 1586. The number stayed high until 1595, reaching a peak of 20 translations on the wars in 1589 and 16 more the following year. In addition, as previously noted, Elizabeth also dispatched English troops to France to help the forces of Henry of Navarre fight the League from 1589 through 1595. The League's main thrust at England came in the summer of 1588 with the sending of Philip II's proud, invincible armada. Although the fleet was Spanish, its appearance was closely linked to the League's activities in France. As Garrett Mattingly has masterfully shown, Philip could send the armada without fear of French interference because his Guise partners had skillfully reduced France to chaos by the time the great fleet sailed. Nor did this interconnection between the course of events in France and the Spanish threat to England escape English observers. They solemnly reminded each other that the French leaguers had been just as passionately bent upon the extermination of English Protestantism as on that of France, and they pointed out that a League victory in France had been an indispensable ingredient in Philip's plans for the invasion of England. William Warner, a poet, claimed that had the Guises succeeded in winning control of France, then, quote, "Spaniards, nestling over near, had easilier us assailed. For on the theater of France the tragedy was meant of England, too," end quote. Similarly, in Christopher Marlowe's dramatization of the French Wars, a play entitled The Massacre of Paris, Henry III justified his murder of the Duke of Guise by asking rhetorically, quote, "Did he not draw a sort of English priests from Douai to the seminary at Reims to hatch forth treason against their natural queen? Did he not cause the King of Spain's huge fleet to threaten England and to menace me?" End quote. Thus it is evident that England's intense interest in the French Wars of Religion was more than simple Protestant partisanship. From the very beginning, the English saw that their own security and independence were inextricably intertwined with the course of events in France. Patriotism mated happily with religion to produce a strong interest in the warfare in France. Such close attention to events in France could not help but affect the image which the English held of their French neighbors. As might be expected, the centuries of warfare between the two countries during the Middle Ages had produced a tendency in England to view France in less than complimentary terms. In a way, the wars of religion acted to confirm English prejudice and hostility. After all, the Protestant version of God's clear truth was getting a much rougher reception in France than it had in England, a fact which some English observers were quick to note. John Stubbs, in his famous 1579 pamphlet, A Gaping Gulf, which protested against the rumored nuptials between Elizabeth and the Duke of Alençon, drew a stark contrast between an England which had forsaken error and France, which he called, quote, "a den of idolatry, a kingdom of darkness, confessing Belial and serving Baal," end quote. Other writers denounced France for being, quote, "a cruel nurse to God's elect," end quote, and warned that French persecutions had so provoked the divinity that his wrath was coming to be directed, quote, "specially against France," end quote. At the same time, English observers who saw the wars in less sanctified terms often tended to become irritated by France's Huguenots, whose godliness they considered less an ornament than an obstacle in the path of their winning the wars and thus helping to safeguard England. By the 1590s, the Huguenots were being roundly attacked in England for having alienated many Frenchmen by forbidding dancing, defacing altars, and generally making pious nuisances of themselves. The volatile French, it was smugly concluded, would have been far wiser to have had a moderate, tasteful reformation like that in England. These irritants notwithstanding, in general, the wars of religion seem to have done more to upgrade the English image of France than to hurt it. The Huguenots might have been exasperating from time to time, but they were on God's side and England's, and were generally accorded a great deal of admiration. Of necessity, this admiration involved revising a good part of the English image of the French. For before the wars began, it was apparently accepted without question in England that the French nation was composed of boastful, treacherous cowards. The experience of anxiously observing the fortunes of the Huguenot armies, though, and fighting side by side with these French warriors, did much to make such malevolent characterizations obsolete in England. By the end of the wars, English observers were proclaiming that the French, quote, are men of great courage and valor, end quote, whose cavalry could beat, quote, double their number, end quote, of any in Christendom. Indeed, some of the English participants in the wars found the serene contempt for personal danger with which French soldiers faced the enemy to be more than a little discomforting. One wrote back from the siege of Rouen in 1591, after taking a leisurely tour of the siege works, his French guide blissfully ignoring the shot which kept whizzing past them, that, quote, had it not been that a foolish, hardy Frenchman would have said that an Englishman durst not adventure his life fondly as he, I could have been contented to have been in our trenches, end quote. A great deal of English admiration was also lavished upon Henry of Navarre, the Huguenot leader who became King Henry IV of France in 1589. He was said to be as valiant as England's Edward III or Henry V, and as blessed a bringer of true religion as Henry VIII had been. One enthusiastic observer even implicitly raised him above England's own hero kings by proclaiming that he was, quote, the most heroic and magnanimous king, the most victorious and invincible warrior that ever unsheathed sword for a kingdom. So that I think if we seek amongst all history and over all the face of the whole world besides, we cannot find a king of a greater race and more noble courage than this, end quote. Henry's personal luster was dimmed perceptibly in 1593 when he despaired of ever convincing his Catholic subjects to accept a heretic king and return to the Roman faith. This, however, did not seriously affect the tendency for English views of French character to become less harsh and hostile. The wars of religion were not, of course, the only ingredients in this mellowing process. The Elizabethans were predisposed to look more kindly upon the French than their ancestors had, partly because of the ominous rise of Spanish power during the 16th century. This was leading them to regard Spain rather than France as England's natural enemy and chief object of hatred. Nor should we overlook the healing work of time, which was allowing the bitter memories of medieval warfare between France and England to sink into ever dimmer recesses of the English mind. At the same time, the development of printing allowed English readers to become far more familiar with the achievements of French history and culture than their forebears had been. By the end of the 16th century, English views of France were far less likely to be based on prejudiced ignorance than they once had been. Yet when all this is said, the wars of religion still maintain a central role in mitigating English hostility toward the French. By presenting the English with Huguenot heroes, upon whose courage, wisdom, and determination, the survival of both God's truth and England's independence partially depended, the wars made it impossible to continue to lump all Frenchmen together in one unsavory package. This appears most clearly, perhaps, in John Stubbs' pamphlet, A Gaping Gulf. No one would accuse Stubbs of being friendly toward the French, for his work fairly bristled with Francophobe sentiments. And yet he was far more tentative about the validity of his insults than earlier writers had been, because of his admiration for the French Huguenots and their valiant struggle. Indeed, it would appear that his ill will was limited to French Catholics, rather than embracing all Frenchmen indiscriminately. While it was natural for an Englishman to hate the French, he said, this hatred did not apply to the, quote, humble, mild, persecuted, and religious Frenchmen, end quote, of the Huguenot movement. If a Frenchman embraced the Protestant faith, he added, quote, we receive him as a well-beloved brother, and our old grudging nature against the French in this respect is expelled, end quote. Thus, the French Wars of Religion aroused enormous interest in England, partly for religious reasons, and partly because England's stake in avoiding Aiguille's victory in France was quickly and clearly perceived. To some extent, the wars, with their seemingly endless cycles of persecution, massacres, and atrocities, tended to reinforce English dislike of France. More importantly, though, by presenting the English with French heroes to admire, as well as villains to hate, the wars also played a very significant role in the weakening of English Francophobia during the final decades of the 16th century. Thank you.
I think it's a kind of complicated relationship here. The English, by the end of the Middle Ages, were convinced that France was an absolute despotism. You get Sir John Fortescue's work in 1470, proclaiming that the French are slaves or worms. This is reflected in later English writings, particularly up to about the time the Wars of Religion began. Hall's Chronicle, for example, whenever the French during the Hundred Years' War will turn the English. English, for example, show some admiration to Henry II, King of France, because he was a strong king able to keep order. By the 1590s, the English, you get some English statements to the effect that the French kings really have a job on their hands trying to keep order among such a turbulent people, and a little bit more sympathy for the efforts of the French monarch. At the same time, they're beginning to read Audin, they're beginning to read Du Halyan, and the commentators at the end of the 16th century, such as Henry Wotton, Robert Dallington, have a little bit more sophisticated view of the French monarchy. They see that it's not absolute. They see that there are bridles on the French crown. They do recognize that there are significant differences between the French monarchy and their own, that the French crown has many more paid officials, for example. This is something they go into. But I would say that by the end of the 15th century, they're a little bit less concerned about constitutional differences between themselves and the French than they were earlier, actually.
So they think it all the same. You started out mentioning the successive problem that was had anyway. Did they begin to think in the 16th century on the notion of succession or means of obtaining the crown? I mean, did they take some of the French examples to defend Elizabeth's position against Catholic charges?
The only mentions of French succession I came across were just, devastating indictments of the Salic law. This was this seemed to interest me tremendously. Other than that, I can't recall it.
I have a question for Mr. Slumberg. Now, in the 16th century, the French policy of forest administration is fairly well turned around from what we would call rather passive, rather short-sighted policy to rather a centralized forest policy to produce a certain amount of wood for such things as the navy. And this is also the case in Germany, particularly for industrial uses. But the reputation is that in England, as evidenced from the treatise of John Manwood at the end of the century, England really doesn't advance very much in the rational management of forest resources. Now, historically, navies are one of the major consumers of quality timber. Is there ever any evidence of Henry VIII developing a timber policy for purposes of raising his navy?
I haven't found any yet. I've read almost all the secondary articles on Henry's navy, and I've never seen that mentioned. I read several of the giants who wrote the history of the English Navy and the parts on the Henrician Navy, and I haven't seen any mention of that. I didn't see anything in the papers about the forest. So you know how big the letters and papers are to use, and my process was to search under ships, vessels, navy, and so forth, and then check every reference.